On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Brian Chee and Mr. Curtis Franklin back on the show. ISPs argue that big tech should foot the bill for broadband construction. Is the future of digital infrastructure actually funding? Plus, we're joined by Keithan Karkonis. He's EVP and GM of Salesforce Sales Cloud to dive into the transformative power of generative AI for sales growth and how it's revolutionizing CRM for small businesses. You definitely shouldn't miss it. Quiet on the set.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 559, recorded September 1st, 2023. Sales forcing AI. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Bitwarden. Get the open source password manager that can help you stay safe online. Get started with a free Teams or Enterprise plan trial, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. And by Lookout. Whether on a device or in the cloud, your business data is always on the move. Minimize risk, increase visibility, and ensure compliance with Lookout's unified platform. Visit lookout.com today. Welcome to Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide to the big world of the enterprise. I can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in some professionals and some experts, starting with very own Curtis Franklin. He's principal analyst at Omdia, and he is the man who has the pulse on the enterprise. Welcome back, Curtis. How's your week been?
It's been a busy week doing follow-up from the Black Hat and DEF CON that we're still getting calls on. Starting to look forward to the fall. A lot of good stuff happening there. I'm getting a big report that's going to publishing, doing a couple of small articles, including one at Dark Reading, and setting up my research agenda for the coming year, which is always really interesting and a lot of fun. So I'm staying busy, dodging hurricanes as well. So we're going to call it a good week. I'm just really happy that I've got 3 days now to relax, breathe, and recuperate before hitting the formal start of business fall here.
Thank you, Curtis, for being here. Also, the welcome back, our favorite network and gadget guy, Mr. Brian G. Speaking of getting away from hurricanes, you're Mr. Ballistic Kevlar guy over there. How did everything go?
That worked. We had to go and kind of gripe at the installer again. Some of the connections, you know, to the bolts are a little too tight. So he's coming back to go and fix those. So that ought to be good. And I figured one of the issues I'm going to have is as I get older and I'm not going to be able to put quite as much oomph behind putting this stuff in, boot jacks should give me a nice extra set of leverage. What I am doing, though, is I'm waiting on the hurricane and everybody, you know, to let the home improvement companies settle down a little bit, restock. I need to go and buy some wood. The Central Florida Fairgrounds needs some racks, but we need to seal them up and supply it with filtered air, you know, pressurized air. So I'm actually using some exhaust fans and a HEPA filter so that I can force air through. Apparently, some of those buildings get really, really hot, and we've been cooking some switches. So I'm building a rack from scratch so that we can pressurize the front and make sure air flows through, even when you could probably make a chicken in some of those places as the summer gets even hotter.
You always get the fun stuff, Brian. Well, thank you so much for being here. We have lots to talk about. In fact, we have a really great guest coming up. ISPs argue that the big tech should foot the bill for broadband construction and the future of digital infrastructure. The question is it funding? Plus, we're joined by Keithan Karkonis. He's EVP and GM of Salesforce. Is it Sales Cloud? We're going to dive into the transformative power of generative AI for sales growth and how it's actually revolutionizing the CRM for small business. Lots to talk about there, so definitely stick around. Remember to go ahead and subscribe to Twit over at twit.tv/Twit. But before we get to all the goodness of the show, let's go ahead and jump to this week's news blips. This week, a significant warning has been issued by the BCS, the Chartered Institute of IT, regarding the government's online safety bill. The primary concern, the bill's requirement for tech companies to scan encrypted messages could significantly damage the UK's reputation for data security. Now, the BCS's latest study suggests that compromising end-to-end encryption can result in a systemic security risk, potentially affecting millions of phone users. As the bill returns for its third reading in the House of Lords, Adam Leon-Smith, chair of the BCS Fellows Technical Advisory Group, asserts that the government is aiming to legislate technology into existence, bypassing broader solutions like education, training, and public awareness. Furthermore, the regulator Ofcom could soon have the power to mandate scanning technology without judicial oversight. Now, this potential overreach has elicited strong reactions from major encrypted message providers, including WhatsApp and Signal. Both warn of possible service withdrawals from the UK if the bill is passed. The legislation is also threatens the UK's standing in cross-border communications and may compromise data security, creating vulnerabilities ripe for exploitation. Such changes could lead to the UK facing economic repercussions similar to what Australia has encountered with their telecommunications legislation from 2018. Finally, the BCS highlights the need for the balanced approach, stressing that compromising encryption may have unforeseen consequences. Policymakers are urged to consider not only technological interventions, but also educational and public awareness efforts to ensure a safer digital landscape.
Well, just in case you were running out of reasons to hate cyber criminal gangs, the United Nations has just given you another one. The UN estimates that about 120,000 victims are being held in Myanmar, 100,000 in Cambodia, with thousands more in Laos, the Philippines, and Thailand. What are we talking about? People forced to work in cybercrime gangs. The report, which was covered in an article on Dark Reading, estimates that gangs have held these workers and forced them to work in what amounts to electronic sweatshops in order to generate billions of dollars in revenue for the criminal organizations. Worse, Pia Oberoi, UN senior advisor and author of the report, says that governmental and regional corruption has allowed these operations to continue and to grow. Now, it looks like these online criminal operations really took off during the COVID epidemic, when more traditional criminal activities like gambling, casinos, and houses of prostitution were shut down because of disease control efforts. Not surprisingly, both Interpol and the UN say that strong multinational efforts are required to shut down these operations. The UN also recommends the implementation of, quote, human rights protections in legislation on cybercrimes and internet governance at the national, regional, and global levels, end quote. The UN report goes on to say that such a holistic approach provides the only solution to breaking the cycle of impunity and ensuring protection and justice for the people who've been trafficked and abused within this complex phenomenon.
Well, some of the material I'm talking about on this blip comes from the alltechsoft.com blog and talks about engineering issues. But a lot of this also comes from my experience as in the DevOps world. So a lot of the reasons people have moved to Java is the so-called code portability. So in theory, better code structure, the Java language is not a free platform like many others. Java was owned by Sun Microsystems and is now owned by Oracle. The downside is that for commercial use, Java is now requiring a license. The other downside is my experience has been that mixing different versions of Java runtime modules have been fraught with bugs, and there's no such thing as compiling a complete code system, and the requirement for the runtimes are specific to a version. So while there has been a goal of backwards compatibility, that goal hasn't been achieved, forcing various systems to become orphaned. So again, I'm going to grind a little bit of my grist on this. Java is also quite cumbersome and very much slower than compiled languages like C# or C++, but it does have the advantage of being designed for splitting tasks between server and client. I personally like Python for this type of architecture, and now with Microsoft adding Python support in Excel, combined with such strong support of Python in several embedded systems like the Raspberry Pi and such, I've wondered the wisdom of how much effort computer science programs have placed in only teaching Java instead of the multi-language curriculum of when I went through my computer science program. My point is that we shouldn't be placing so many eggs into a single basket, and we should be evaluating development languages based upon the task rather than language du jour.
Amen to that. Thank you, Brian. When a recent revelation, cybersecurity researchers at SlashNext have identified a burgeoning threat threatening targeting Airbnb account holders. That's right. The alarming trend uses a slew of malicious techniques, some familiar to the IT community, to compromise accounts. Very interesting article, actually, from the Hacker Read here. Now, among these methods, cyber criminals employ stealers, a type of malware extracting sensitive data, and they also capitalize on stolen cookies, sorry, browser cookies, and specialized tools called account checkers. Now, when access is secured, these accounts can be manipulated for fraudulent bookings, unauthorized purchases, and most worryingly, the theft of their personal data. Stimulantly, the underground digital market has seen a surge in the availability of compromised Airbnb accounts, some being sold for as low as a dollar. For IT professionals, the underlying message here is indispensable need for robust security practices. It's essential to bolster account security through strong passwords and two-factor auth. Plus, additionally, it's advisable to exercise caution when booking only with reputable Airbnb hosts. That's right. Make sure they're reputable. And refrain from actually sharing personal information indiscriminately. As cyber threats have become increasingly sophisticated, remaining proactive and vigilant is the most crucial thing ever. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we have the News Bites. But before we get to the News Bites, we do have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Bitwarden, the only open source cross-platform password manager anywhere, anytime. The security analyst Steve Gibson has even switched over, and that's a big plus because he is he scrutinizes these things, and he loves this. With Bitwarden, all of the data in your vault is end-to-end encrypted, not just your passwords. In the summer of 2023, G2 Enterprise Grid report, they solidified their position as the highest performing password manager for the enterprise, leaving competitors in the dust. Bitwarden protects your data and privacy by adding strong randomly generated passwords for each of your accounts. Go further with the username generator. Use this all the time. You can create unique usernames for each account and use any of the 5 integrated email alias services. Transparently view all of Bitwarden's code available right there on GitHub. On top of being public to the world, Bitwarden also has professional third-party audits performed yearly, and that results in getting published on their website. And Bitwarden is open source security that you can actually trust. Share private data securely with coworkers across departments or even the entire company with fully customizable and adaptive plans. Bitwarden's Teams organization option is $3 a month per user, with their enterprise organization plan is just $5 per month per user. Individuals always get Bitwarden's basic account for unlimited passwords. You can upgrade anytime to a premium account for less than a dollar a month, or bring the entire family, which I have, with their family organization option, which gives them up to 6 users premium features for only $3.33 a month. Bitwarden just released a new passwordless SSO feature. SSO with trusted devices lets users log into Bitwarden and decrypt their vault after using SSO on a registered trusted device, no master password needed. This new solution makes it even easier for enterprise users to stay safe and secure with Bitwarden. Learn more about SSO with trusted devices at bitwarden.com/twit. At Twit, we're fans of password managers. Get started with Bitwarden's free trial of a Teams or enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. That's bitwarden.com/twit. And we thank Bitwarden for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's time for the Bites. Now, there's a debate heating up in both the U.S. and Europe that could reshape the financial structure of our broadband landscape. Now, internet service providers or ISPs are making their case known. They believe that tech behemoths like Amazon or Google or Netflix should contribute financially to the broadband infrastructure they so heavily use. And when you consider that just six of these tech giants account for half the world's web traffic, it certainly stirs up a thought-provoking debate on responsibility and contribution. Now, in Europe, the conversation is leaning towards seeking direct payments from these tech giants. Across the Atlantic, the U.S., there's a slightly different tune being played. The idea here is to create a centralized fund managed by the government dedicated to broadband. Now, the concept draws inspiration from the current Universal Service Fund. However, the Biden administration is treading carefully here. They voice concerns over potential net neutrality violations, and there's an underlying fear that such a move could inadvertently increase costs for you and me and the end user. Interesting take. The tech giants in question aren't merely spectators here in this debate. They're speaking up, of course, highlighting that they've made substantial investments in areas like content delivery networks, which in essence every one of the ISPs load. Europe's regulatory body for electronic communications seems to echo this sentiment, saying they've found no signs of these tech firms free riding on ISPs. But the plot thickens, as there's already a debate among U.S. lawmakers about whether these companies should contribute to broadband subsidiary. And if it's not enough food for thought, some suggest adding surcharge on broadband revenues to bolster the Universal Service Fund. Decisions made in the arena could profoundly impact our industry's trajectory. So we should keep an eye on this one for sure. I want to bring my co-host back in because this is a really interesting one. I mean, this is a different take on moving our infrastructure forward potentially, but using big tech to do it. What do you guys think of that?
I think one of the things I need to be upfront about is I happen to be part owner of a wireless internet service provider. And as one of the little guys, the last mile ISP are right now bearing the vast majority of the cost of supporting the internet because it's all paid with transit fees. So look at it like a funnel. You know, the funnel's coming down from the big six and it slowly goes out as it hits more and more end users. So as a result, the pipe to the so-called tier three ISPs has to be bigger and bigger and bigger. And trust me, those pipes are not cheap. I had to pay for one. I've had to pay for many. It's not something very nice. Flipping the model over so the fees are paid more towards the source has been a conversation among ISPs for a very long time. In fact, I remember it back in the mid-90s at the Interop show as being one of the big topics that came up during the conference. You know, how do we monetize the internet has been one of the topics of internet related conferences for at least the last couple of decades. So I, for one, am soapboxing a little bit. Sorry. I think, yeah, the fees should be a little more even. And if they even out a little bit more, maybe, just maybe, your monthly service fee for your internet service provider can start leveling out also.
You think, Curtis, is this just Comcast hiding behind a curtain trying to get people to pay for their stuff?
Well, yeah. And I'll also say that the question, could this lead to more expensive internet fees? Well, of course it will. You know, let's be honest. Whether we're talking about the large backbone carriers or anyone down to your local ISP, each of these companies has a profit margin that they really want to maintain, whether it's 10%, 20%, or 50%. They've got their margin. And if something increases their cost, well, then they will raise their price in order to maintain their margin. It's just the way it works. Now, the interesting thing is that what we're hearing here is not a new conversation. I remember similar conversations when we started having data be part of the cellular network, and especially when we started seeing streaming media become part of the cellular network, when we started seeing streaming media become part of the internet. You know, it's probably been 20 years ago now that we hit the point where streaming media, whether audio, video, or a combination, became the bulk of traffic on the internet. If you just look at the sheer number of packets being passed. And when you go from the kind of very choppy, intermittent traffic that text-based things, that email, that, you know, control signals represent, to something like streaming media, it blows up all kinds of predictive analytics that were looking at how much capacity was going to be required. And it, with each of these changes, we heard a discussion about whether the consumer of the data, the originator of the data, or the carrier of the data should be responsible for upgrades to the infrastructure to successfully handle the data. Now, I think that it needs to be some sort of shared price. You know, everybody needs to bear some, but this is ultimately going to come down to who has paid for the most effective lobbyists. That may be different on the European side of the Atlantic and our side. It's going to be different around the world, but I do think we are going to almost certainly see some rebalancing of how costs are allocated for the kind of bandwidth we increasingly need to live the lives that we've chosen to lead in this interconnected age.
I'm kind of putting a little bit of a parallel on the fact that, you know, businesses continue to adopt cloud-based solutions. They're obviously relying on really broad, high broadband backbones and infrastructure to make sure that they have high-speed connections and in between their businesses, between their clients. Can you maybe draw some parallels between the early days of enterprise networking and today's kind of clamoring for funding, I guess you could say? Is there a potential impact for businesses here as well, Gbert? What do you think?
Well, I'm going to draw a direct comparison. There used to be people like Long Distance USA, Sprint. You would have calling cards so you could go to a payphone. Remember those? And dial an access number and then type in your code. This was called intralata, local area telephone access area. And that used to be federally governed. You know, it was very heavily regulated. You could not sell modems without being certified for that and follow certain rules from the FCC. Well, I was part of a political action group called the Coalition for Competitive Telecommunications, and we fought against the Hawaiian telephone monopoly in Hawaii. We managed to do a lot of talking with the Public Utilities Commission and the state legislature and managed to break the Hawaiian telephone monopoly on intra-LATA communications a full year before the federal government did. Now, the point I need to make here is all the carriers were saying, oh, this is going to be terrible. We're going to lose so much money. We're going to have to jack up our rates sky high. And people aren't going to be able to afford to have long distance telecom. Well, no, they didn't. In fact, the president of Hawaiian Telephone and I were at a charity golf tournament. And even after being persona non grata with Hawaiian Telephone for many years, he and I actually had a very nice conversation and said, you know, the breaking the monopoly and deregulating the intra-LATA communications market was actually the best thing that ever happened to us. We made so much money that we just left our rates right where they are. I think we're going to see the same thing. Right now, the big boys are fighting this because they think it's going to be bad. I think evening out the transit fees so that more people can enter the market is actually going to increase the market for everyone. Because keep in mind, when we had more bandwidth available to the end user, we started getting little things like Carl Auerbach invented this thing called IPTV. You know, that was the start of Netflix and all the rest. But it couldn't have happened because when Carl first started all that up, you could only do it over corporate network because that's the only thing that had enough bandwidth. Now, all of a sudden, we had applications because we had more bandwidth. I don't think this is necessarily bad. I think the giant ISP, especially the tier one ISPs, need to just look at history and see how well deregulating and evening out the market really can become.
Right. Now, obviously, if we think back a little bit on some of the disruptions that have happened in tech, you know, big tech does start to contribute to broadband funding, could this change how they approach enterprise services and how they're done, and in turn, how businesses actually protect their data? So maybe it's more of a security question, Curtis. What do you think?
Well, I think that what we're seeing here, and let's do note, one huge change that has occurred worldwide. We see it go back and forth a little bit. But it's not that many years ago that if you were putting up an operation in a new city, in a new nation, you would call the incumbent telco and you would have dedicated data lines pulled to your facility. You could provision them with the services you want. You would pay for the bandwidth you want. They would be expensive. You would have often a 90 to 120 day waiting time before they could be pulled and provisioned, but you knew what you were getting. Today, in most places, that same scenario, you're going to call your local ISP and get what's called commodity internet. In other words, the same backbone connection and the same last mile that anybody could get, you know, your local sports bar, the corner barbershop, or you doing whatever enterprise thing you're doing in this location. That has been a huge change. And on the one hand, it has made it much faster because you could usually have that pulled and provisioned within 48 hours. It tended to be less expensive, but it also tended to be less knowable. Why? Because you're sharing bandwidth with an awful lot of people. So I do think that we're going to see more change as, here's a prediction, we will see more ISPs telling enterprise customers that they can get guaranteed performance if they will pay extra. And that's where the subsidies come from. In many cases, what it's going to mean is that the ISP is pulling what amounts to the same thing that used to be a dedicated network connection. They're just calling it commodity internet. They're paying for it. Everybody's happy, except the old incumbent telcos who still miss out on the giant paychecks they would get. But I do think that it's going to continue this evolution in how enterprises, small businesses, everyone else provisions internet to their local facilities.
It will definitely be interesting to see how organizations adjust if this does happen. So we'll have to wait and see. Well, folks, that does it for the Bytes. Next up, we have an amazing guest. But before we get to the guest, we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Lookout. Business has changed forever. Boundaries to where we work or even how we work have disappeared. That means your data is always on the move, whether you're in the device, on the cloud, across networks, or a local coffee shop. Well, that's great for your workforce. It's a challenge for IT security. Lookout helps you control your data and free your workforce. With Lookout, you'll gain complete visibility into all of your data so you can minimize risk from external and internal threats, plus ensure compliance. That's right. By seamlessly securing hybrid work, your organization doesn't have to sacrifice productivity for security. And Lookout makes IT security a lot simpler as well. Working with multi-point solutions and legacy tools in today's environment is just too complex. With its single unified platform, Lookout reduces IT complexity, giving you more time to focus on whatever else comes your way. Good data protection isn't a cage. It's a springboard, letting you and your organization bound toward a future of your making. Visit lookout.com today to learn how to safeguard data, secure hybrid work, and reduce IT complexity. That's lookout.com. And we thank Lookout for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. Today, we have Keithan Karkonis. He's EVP and GM of Sales Cloud from Salesforce. Welcome to the show, Keithan.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's just fun to be on with all of you.
We're excited for you to be here because lots to talk about. So Dreamforce is coming up, so I'm sure there's some stuff to talk about there. But we, you know, we usually start the show because our audience is a large spectrum of experiences, whether they're starting out or all the way up to the CEOs and CTOs of the world. And they love to hear people's origin stories. Can you take us through maybe a short journey through tech and what got you to Salesforce?
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. Believe it or not, my first job was not in tech. I was in sales. Well, my journey started in India, Pune. I'm a computer science engineer. I did my engineering, coding, standard stuff. But then I got fascinated with sales and I took a job in sales. A lot of you probably will not remember this. Back then, there were Silicon Graphics machines and I used to sell Silicon Graphics machines to defense and establishments and all that. Got back into coding, came to America sometime early 2000, was in Cisco Systems. In San Jose, did that for a few years. Really loved the idea of building products, software products. It's fascinating how fast you can iterate and how quickly you can have a value realization for your customers. But while building the products, got more interested in the business of product also. So did my MBA part-time, couldn't afford full-time. You guys know it. Have to pay the rent. So part-time, did my MBA, had a lot of fun learning, landed in 2010, landed in Salesforce. The cloud was just getting started. And then ever since, it's been the cloud and mobile and social and now AI. So a lot of, you know, just kind of blessed, very grateful.
Thank you for that. Yeah, I think it's been a great journey for you. And I think what we're seeing in the latest releases, especially from Salesforce, is pretty exciting. Now, I wanted to start really quick before we got into Salesforce's stuff, just some general questions around what people from organizations continue to wonder about from an AI perspective. Now, we've witnessed an increased integration of AI in every business process around the world. What do you think is the primary challenges organizations are facing when they're trying to balance the rapidly changing ecosystem of technology advancements to basically sustainable growth?
Oh, no, absolutely. And I think so. You kind of hit it. The biggest challenge people are facing is connecting AI to business outcomes and sustainable growth. I think so. It's really important to have that conversation in a connective tissue fashion. But I'll tell you, we talked to thousands of customers. We have pioneered AI for the enterprise. You should come to Dreamforce. We'll talk about that at the end. Because it's the largest AI conference that's happening just in 10 days. But I'll tell you two things. Number one, the biggest challenge people have is trusting AI. There's a lot of anxiety, rightfully so. There's a lot of concerns, rightfully so. Is how do I trust this? How do I know this is right for me? How do I know my data is safe? How do I know this is going to help me accountable? You know, all the concerns around AI are not about AI, but about the trust in AI. And that's where our focus is on trust in AI. Second point is the purpose of AI. A lot of people are approaching, to begin with, you know, there's, of course, a certain coolness to AI, right? And it's kind of cool to, I want to geek out on AI right now, and I'm just waiting for you to open the door for me and let me do that. But, you know, AI on the side is a sideshow. You want to think about how AI can transform the business. For example, in sales, how can AI help a sales leader increase sales productivity by 25%? Now, that's a business metric that your board and your CEO can get behind. And AI can help you do that. just by helping every sales rep write automated emails with Einstein GPT, well, that's something you can do. So connecting to business outcomes like that, I think is super, super important. And everybody is learning together. And that's why we are throwing this biggest AI conference in the world.
So, having worked in the CRM ERP space for a while as an engineering leader, I can tell you that obviously the generative AI has a ton of potential from streamlining sales and customer experience. It's definitely evident there. One question I have for you is, given the rising influence of AI in sales and customer service, how do you envision the role in the future for human sales representatives, particularly in the context of SMBs? Like what happens there as you kind of combine the two?
Well, life becomes more bearable. No, I mean, jokes apart, jokes apart. Seriously, let me break it down for you. Okay, think about it this way. You are a sales rep, right? You've been in CRM, you've been sales, everybody knows what I'm talking about. Now, on an average, a sales rep is spending more than 40 to 50% of their time in non-selling administrative activities. Sounds kind of reasonable, right? I mean, you guys can know what I'm talking about. What if AI can help you eliminate some of those mundane tasks? That's going to increase your productivity. That's going to increase the quality of your work. That's going to increase the success you achieve in your job. So I think so right now, I think of AI as an accelerant. Artificial intelligence is an accelerant inducer in your personal productivity. And I think so people are going to see a lot of value in that. I think so the nature of the work done by humans is going to be more qualitative, more intuition, more judgment versus just repetitive tasks. And I think so that's very important. Number two is there will always be an evolution of roles that happens. Like 50 years ago, we did not have software engineers, right? We had something else. So I think so there's also this evolution of roles which are just going to drive more value to the workforce. I think so the workforce is going to benefit a lot by AI because of the assistive nature of it. Now, rightfully so, it's okay to have anxiety around, hey, are the Terminators going to come and, when is all that going to happen?
Right.
AGI, general intelligence and all that. Look, I feel it's absolutely fair to have that conversation. I feel we are more than a little ways out on that. But I do know for certain AI today has this massive potential to radically improve your efficiency, your productivity, and more importantly, ultimately it comes down to your ability to deliver that personalized one-on-one customer experience.
Right.
Ultimately, everything comes down to that. And that's where AI is going to help you.
Now, kind of like related to that, obviously, is how can businesses ensure they don't lose the personal touch, which often differentiates a smaller company from some of the larger companies and counterparts that are out there? What can they do to ensure that? Because that's some of the fear as well.
Actually, so sorry to contradict you. I actually feel today the world is extremely generic. How many times have you gone to LinkedIn and you've gotten one of those messages? Come on, tell me. And every message looks and feels the same. It's like, or those emails you get, or the advertising you see, or the products you buy. The products are not personalized for you. Not all of them. Some are really well personalized. I can buy Nike shoes, which are really personalized, but not the others. My point is, it's the opposite. I think so AI can help you deliver a more personalized one-on-one at scale service. I'll give you a very concrete example. Writing somebody an email. Now today, you know how people do prospecting. They have a template email and they send that template email to 10,000 people, 10,000 leads, hoping that at least 10 out of those 10,000 will respond. It's a spray and pray. Strategy. Well, it's not a strategy, tactic. But now why? Because you can't personalize emails one-on-one. I mean, you will require hundreds of BDRs to do that. How are you? You're not going to do that. But with AI, with generative AI, now Einstein can look at the profile of the person you're sending the email to, what their background is, what their history with you is, have they bought previous products with you, and then contextualize a very personal one-on-one email. So in fact, AI writing the email is going to feel more personal than a human writing the email. So I think so AI is an accelerant for that too. But of course, it's always important to be cautious. Is applied incorrectly, it can create a negative experience. So it's really important that it's not a silver bullet. You have to apply AI correctly using the right techniques.
Right. Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that's one thing when I talk to organizations, it's hard. It's a little bit to overcome is say, listen, AI is there to help uncover and surface some of the information you didn't know about your customers to make it more personable and give them that personal touch. So that definitely makes sense. And I say one thing that my experience is very richly with LLMs and general AI is that obviously people do have that trust gap, as you mentioned. What can you elaborate a little bit more on maybe some of the critical hurdles people have with generative AI and how they can overcome that kind of fear of AI in the kind of the mainstream sales arena side of things?
Definitely. Look, fear is definitely a normal and a natural thing when it comes to AI. But I'll tell you one thing. There is nothing artificial about artificial intelligence. It's not. It's advanced computing and mathematics done at scale. And I know I'm underselling AI, but it's not like a creature or something. I think so. What's important to understand though is the application of AI needs to be within the trust boundaries of your organization. I think so. It's really important that you as a company, when you think about AI, it's okay to get excited by the use cases, but connect it to the business outcome you hope to achieve. And two, use AI in a trusted manner, because that is the really key thing. How do you preserve the trust of your customers? We always talk, and you will hear about this when we are at Dreamforce in a couple of weeks, is one of the biggest innovations Salesforce has done is not just the AI, but the trust, Einstein trust GPT layer, where I'll tell you simple things like when a particular prompt or a question goes to an LLM, we have invented the idea of zero retention. That means your data is never retained by the model. That's really important. Number two is things like masking, data masking. Number three is things like having boundaries for PII. So all of these things are captured in our ability to deliver trusted AI to you. But ultimately, it comes down to connected to the business process. You want to minimize, you want to maximize productivity for your sales teams. Great. How about you use generative AI to help them create content? What if I tell you Einstein can join you for your meeting and you never have to take meeting notes, but Einstein will auto capture not just the meeting notes, the transcript, which is simple, but will do call summarization, will detect insights on what was said between the lines, and will auto update your CRM for you so you don't have to do anything. So these are like various ways in which you can apply AI in a trusted manner to drive productivity today. And I could keep going on, but
sure. So let's dig into it a little bit more. Survey says the proliferation of AI, obviously in business, is undeniable, but nearly 60% of companies feel that they're a year or two way out. And in fact, in the industry today, only about 54% of AI projects transition from pilot to production. That's interesting information. Now, what do you think the primary barriers there, Keith, and is for how organizations can transition? How can they overcome them?
I'll tell you, it's an excellent point. In fact, I think so. The survey is being generous. I think so. The numbers are more stark than what the survey shows. And I'll tell you why. Two reasons. There are lots of reasons, but I'll prioritize two. Number one, remember I said AI on the side is a sideshow. That's the biggest mistake people make. They say, let me do this science project on the side. It's not connected to your customer impact projects. It's not connected to your front office. You got to have business outcomes and AI in the flow of the work. That is really important. So whatever pilot you decide or POC you decide, connect it to the real business outcome you're hoping to achieve. Number two is, I believe, and this may sound a bit counterintuitively, for successful AI, you need a great data foundation. And every time we talk to our customers, we spend time on build your data foundation connected to trusted AI. That's why at Dreamforce, you're going to see us announce Data Cloud, the ability to harmonize, bring together all your data and then harmonize it so that you can fuel trusted insights. You know, I like to say better data, better insights, faster sales. So I think so these two things is what I would love for people to think about, because it's kind of easy to experiment with AI, right? It's like not that hard. But then very quickly, the novelty goes away and you're like, wait, what am I getting out of this? And these first two points will ensure you don't fall into the, as they say, the trough of disillusionment.
Well, I do want to bring my co-host back in because they're chomping at the bit here to ask some questions. And I know that we don't have too much time left. Let's jump over to Curtis first. Curtis?
Thanks, Lou. I appreciate that. I do have a question. A lot of people have started using just AI when they mean generative AI or large language model AI. And someone will inevitably come back and say, well, we've had AI in our product for years, by which they mean neural nets and other forms. Do you see companies like Salesforce making use of multiple types of AI for different purposes within a product, you know, an entire product suite?
Oh, no, absolutely. You nailed it, right? There's a spectrum and you go beyond the spectrum. You know, it actually started with what we call descriptive analytics, which was visualization. Then it moved to predictive machine learning, and then it moved to generative AI. And very soon we will move into the world of autonomous and AGI. So this is a spectrum. We have been on, but the fun part around this is these are all what I call complementary. It's like passing the baton from one to the other. And I'll give you a very quick, concrete example. Now with ML, machine learning, predictive analytics, as one might call it, you know, we pioneered that in 2016 with Einstein. The Einstein first was focused on predictive, and it could look at your leads and it could tell you which lead has a high propensity to close, or, you know, lead scoring, if you may. But it stopped there. Now, when predictive is complemented with generative AI, now Einstein can not just tell you the lead score, which is predictive, but Einstein can generate that beautiful email for you to send to that person using generative AI. Or Einstein can create that PowerPoint presentation, or Einstein can create that report for you. So I think so it's predictive and generative. Our focus has always been delivering a complete trusted AI platform, and we call that Einstein. It started with predictive, and now it's going to have generative. It's also then going to have autonomous agents to help our customers. I hope that
okay. That's a great answer, but you bring up something in a use where I know we've already seen some companies get into trouble, because I'm aware salespeople love generative AI. They love the way it helps them do the sort of things you've just been describing. But we've seen where it goes through and develops a prospect list for them, mm-hmm. and generates the targeted email message for that list. And occasionally it will go out and develop that prospect list from companies and contacts that have not given the user of the AI permission to send them yep. marketing messages. And when you get into Europe, that's a real problem. That's so a real problem. My question is, you know, how much are we going to have to do work on data governance and practice to stay on the good side of existing regulations while taking advantage of the generative AI?
You nailed it, you know, Curtis. That's the problem and the challenge everybody's going to face. That's why I stressed at the beginning of the show on the trusted AI or the trust layer. Our innovation has been creating that trust layer so that A, your data is not a product for somebody else. B, all the compliance and the governance and the regulations are built in. With our Hyperforce and GDPR compliance, you can use generative AI safely. I think so the challenges customers are going to face is when they are using AI in a non-trusted fashion. And it's really critical that when you're evaluating AI technologies, when you're thinking about building AI applications in your ecosystem, you don't start with AI, but you start with trust. And you ask the questions, Curtis, that you are asking, hey, what about GDPR? What about compliance? What about this? What about that? And then you're like, okay, now let's talk about the cool AI. But this is definitely a challenge. I'm sure the world is also developing new regulations around this. There is now the whole thing around generative AI is generating content, which is training more generative AI, and it's kind of getting into that loop mode right now. We are going to be living in an interesting world for a little bit.
You mentioned training, and I've got one more question, and that is, on the prompts that we use as humans to get results back from the generative AI. I know in the area where I specialize, security, there's a lot of talk about prompt engineering. In other words, coming up with the correct prompt to get a response in the format that will be most useful. How big a process do you think it's going to be to train our users to get the best results from the generative or large language model AI products that are coming on stream?
I honestly believe it's like this again. Remember in the world of coding, there was coding, then there was clicks, not code, and the citizen developer, the rise of the citizen developer happened, where you're not really writing code, but you're kind of building applications. The same thing is happening to prompts. Our approach has been always focused on the business user and simple. So I'll tell you, when you use generative AI or Einstein GPT, we have pre-created prompts for you. Write me an introductory email. So the prompt for it actually is 5 pages long. Now you as a human, you're not even going to see it, but you know, to get the right answer, the grounding, the prompting, it's 5 pages long, and we send it to the LLM. But we are also creating what we call a prompt studio. So Prompt Studio is a clicks, not code approach for you to build your own prompts without having to learn the science behind it. And I think so this is going to be a game changer, is the ability to have out-of-the-box prompt plus a Prompt Studio, which allows you to build these prompts with clicks and not code, with business language and not AI language. And I think so this is where you're going to see. But yeah, prompt engineering is a real thing. A good prompt can generate a great answer. Just like in life, if you need a good answer, you ask a good question.
So, Keithan, we're running a little on time, but we did want to give you a chance to maybe tell the folks at home what are they going to find out at Dreamforce, and what's coming up for Salesforce?
You know, Dreamforce is right around the corner. Believe it or not, I just got off the meeting where we reviewed our keynote for Dreamforce, and it's extremely exciting what we have planned. So September 12th, Dreamforce kicks off in San Francisco, the largest AI conference in the world. More than 50,000 people, 100,000 people are coming. Foo Fighters, great entertainment too. So it's fun. But you know what's more fun is the tremendous amount of innovation that's rolling out this Dreamforce. We are going to be announcing revolutionary data products. We are going to be launching real products, AI for sales, for service, for marketing, for commerce, for analytics, for integration across the customer 360. We are going to help every company become an AI company, because that's what every company is facing now. How do I become an AI company? So come to Dreamforce, and if you can't make it, it's all streamed online. I would say go to dreamforce.com, sign up, thousands of sessions. The second exciting part of Dreamforce, I keep saying, is the largest AI conference in the world. Just look at the speaker list from Sam Altman onwards to everybody, more than 100 luminary speakers coming at Dreamforce, to talk about all these things. And then particularly on Wednesday, September 13th at 9 a.m., the Sales Cloud keynote, where we are announcing some crazy cool AI stuff for salespeople. So come check that out. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for being here. Really appreciate your time.
All right. Bye.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the Best Staying Enterprise and IT podcast in the universe. So definitely tune your podcast to Twilight. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially Tim, my co-host. Sorry, the very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, thank you so much for being here. What's going on for you this week, and how can people get a hold of you?
Well, the big things for me are going to be some writing. I've got a report coming up for our subscribers over at Omnia.com. I've got a piece that's going to be showing up over at Dark Reading on AI. And then, as I said, I'm going to be working on setting up my research plan for the coming year. I may also be able to sneak in a piece looking at some of the big things that I saw back at DEF CON and Black Hat before that gets too old. Keep an lookout on my social media feeds for that. Best place to keep up with me is on LinkedIn. That's Curtis Franklin. I still do some stuff over on X at KG4GWA. And I'm trying to give more love to Mastodon, KG4GWA, at mastodon.sdf.org. One way or another, I hope that you will look me up, follow me, and drop me a note. Let me know what you're interested in and what you would like to see in the news about the world of cybersecurity.
Thank you, Curtis. We also have to thank Mr. Brian G. Brian, thanks so much for being here. Any way you can tell us what's going on for you this week and where people can find you?
Well, you know, I whine all the time, you know, whine. I complain about all kinds of things, and a lot of my complaining happens on Twitter. I'm still ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. You're also welcome to throw show ideas, complaints, you know, pats on the back, things like that. My email is Chebert, spelled Cheebert at twit.tv. You're also welcome to use Twiet at twit.tv, and that'll help all the hosts. And one of the things I'm going to be, you know, probably griping about is the splinters and things I pick up building a rack, cabinet rack from scratch. Sadly, as much as I love all these metal racks, they're pretty heavy and they're not cheap. So the idea is I'm going to build it out of 2x4s and plywood. If all goes well, I hope to have a nice thin sheet of plywood where I can laser etch the Central Florida Fairground logo on so it'll look nice. And that way I can go and put it up on top of a little lobby roof and push some filtered forced air in it. You know, the whole idea is I'm trying to keep my gear from melting. And instead of blowing a lot of money, especially in shipping for a commercial rack, I'm going to build one from scratch. So a big thank you to the folks on Thingiverse for some of the fittings and also the DIY stuff, just all kinds of good stuff. I like building it myself, and I'm going to hopefully post some pictures of the process on building it from scratch.
Thanks, Cheever. Thanks for being here. Well, folks, I also want to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to get your enterprise and IT goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen to get your enterprise show titles and all the information for the week, right? So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twiet. There you'll find all of our amazing back episodes. There's a ton of them there, and you should definitely listen to them. But more importantly, next to those videos, you can get those helpful subscribe and download links. That's right. Get your audio version or your video version of your choice. Listen on any one of your podcast applications, whether it's Podcatcher, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, you name it. We're on all of them. So definitely subscribe and support the show. Plus, you may have also heard, we also have Club Twit as well. Really, it's a members-only ad-free podcast service with a bonus Twit Plus feed that you can't get anywhere else. And it's only $7 a month. And there's a lot of great things you get with that Club Twit. One of them is exclusive access to members-only Discord channels and server. That's right. I'm on it right now. There's a lot of great channels. It's really well-structured and run. And I'll tell you, a lot of great people on there. So definitely help and join Club Twit. Be part of that movement. Go to twit.tv/Club Twit. Now, Club Twit also offers corporate group plans as well. That's right. It's a great way for your team to have access to all of our ad-free tech podcasts. And the plans start with 5 members at a discounted rate of $6 each per month. It can add as many seats as you like there. And this is a great way for your IT department, your developers, your tech teams to stay up to date, to access to all of our podcasts. And just like that regular membership, they can join the Twit Discord server and get that Twit Plus bonus feed as well. So definitely have them join, get your organization on there. Plus, get this, your family can also enjoy. That's right. Family plans is only $12 a month. You get two seats with that. And then you can also add as many seats as you like after that, $6 each per seat. And they get all the advantages of the single plan as well. So lots of options there. Jeff, definitely join Club Twit at twit.tv/Club Twit. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family members, and your coworkers with the gift of Twit, because we talk about some tech, a lot of fun tech topics on the show. I guarantee they will find them fun and interesting as well. So definitely have them join the fun. And if you're available, that's right, Fridays at 1:30 p.m. Pacific time, we do this show absolutely live. It's live right now. Come see how the pizza's made. Go to live.twit.tv. You can see all the behind the scenes, all the banter that we do before and after the show, lots of fun stuff going on. And if you're going to watch the show live on the live stream, you might as well jump into our IRC channel as well. That's Twit Live channel. You can get there by going to irc.twit.tv on your web browser. It'll jump you right into the channel right away. It's really a great place to see people have conversations, show titles, whether it's conversations about the show, questions for our guests, lots of great stuff there. So definitely jump into our chat room and be part of that fun as well. I want you to contact me. I want you to hit me up, whether it's on Twitter or, sorry, X. I'm Lou MM over there. Of course, I'm also on Threads. I'm Lou MPM. Lou MPM, that's right. There I post all my enterprise tidbits. Of course, I'm also on Mastodon, Lou MM at twit.social. I want you to direct message me, whether it's right there in public on the boards or the walls, whatever you want to do. I'd love to hear from you. Of course, I'm also on LinkedIn. I have lots of great conversations each and every week. In fact, last week I had a conversation around AI integration into automation. It was a really good conversation that I had there. So definitely hit me up. If you want to know what I do during my normal work week at Microsoft, go to developers.microsoft.com/office. There it is. Great way for your organization to customize Office and make it more productive for you. And in fact, if you have Microsoft 365, open up Excel right now. There's a new Automate tab. It's an awesome tab. You can literally create macros, create automations for your spreadsheets and your workbooks, and then you can run them on Power Automate. You can schedule them, you can trigger them, however you want to do it. It's a really awesome way to start making things more automatable. Get those mundane processes out of the way and automate them. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and to Lisa. They continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we couldn't do the show without them. So thank you for all their support over the years. Of course, I want to thank all the staff and engineers at Twit as well. And of course, I want to thank Mr. Brian Chi just one more time. He's not only our co-host, but he's our tireless producer. That's right. He does all the bookings and the plannings for the show, and we really couldn't do the show without him. So thank you, Chibert, for all your support. And of course, before we sign out, thank you to our editor for today, because they're going to make us look good after the fact, cut out all of our mistakes. Of course, thank you to our TD for today, the talented Mr. Ant Pruitt. Ant, it's always great to have you, my friend. What's going on this week for you on Twit?
Well, Mr. Lou, continuing to do as much as I can for our Club Twit members with different events. You know, we have an event coming up next week at the time of this recording featuring sci-fi authors Daniel Suarez as well as Mr. Hugh Howey. We're going to have a chat with them. But then we're still going to have a good old AMA with you, Mr. Lou. So I hope folks are getting ready for that. But in the meantime, I'm getting ready for football because it's football season. Good show, sir.
Love that. Well, thank you, Ann. Appreciate it. Well, until next time, I'm Louis Breska, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twit.
Hey, I'm Rod Pyle, Editor-in-Chief of Ad Astra Magazine, and each week I join with my co-host to bring you This Week in Space, the latest and greatest news from the final frontier. We talk to NASA chiefs, space scientists, engineers, educators, and artists, and sometimes we just shoot the breeze over what's hot and what's not in space books and TV. And we do it all for you, our fellow true believers. So whether you're an armchair adventurer or waiting for your turn to grab a slot in Elon's Mars rocket, join us on This Week in Space and be part of the greatest adventure of all time. We'll be right back.